We're entering the fifth summer of the war that began when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And the balance of analytical opinion has shifted from emphasising Ukraine's difficulties to looking at Russia's. Its progress on the battlefield is both bloody and glacial. Ukrainian drones strike Moscow. There's talk of weakening resolve. That would be great news for Ukraine's allies, including Britain. But what do the experts make of it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. To help us with this one, I'm joined by the BBC's Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, the Financial Times Ukraine correspondent and author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine, Christopher Miller, and Angela Stent, who's senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a former US National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia. First of all, let's look at the situation in Russia. Steve Rosenberg, what was the reaction in Moscow to last weekend's drone attack?
It wasn't the first time that drones had come close to Moscow or into Moscow, but this particular attack was a large one and certainly did make an impression on people I spoke to. We went to one apartment block just on the edge of Moscow that had got hit by a drone, and there was a large crowd of people standing outside looking up at the damage the drone had done. And some people said to me, we're actually quite frightened because now we realise that in the middle of the night, you know, a drone could hit our apartment block. And there was this sense that people in and around Moscow have realised that the front line in this war could suddenly appear in their living room. And for so long, so many Russians had sort of pretended that the war was happening a long way away or was happening somewhere on television that it didn't really affect their lives. But it's becoming much harder now for people to convince themselves of that.
Steve, does an incident like this get reported very much? Is it big news on Russian TV?
It was reported for a time on Russian television, I think because of the scale of the attack. But then reporting sort of dropped off and it wasn't mentioned very much. It did get mentioned in the papers the next day, but that was it. So, you know, it changes on a case-by-case basis. Sometimes things are reported, sometimes things are not reported. And a few days ago, the Moscow authorities brought in a new rule, basically prohibiting citizens, journalists, from reporting or filming the consequences of drone attacks in the Russian capital. From now on, apparently, we're only able to quote official information on the website of the Moscow mayor or the Russian defense ministry.
Talking more generally, Steve, how are the Russian citizens viewing the war at the moment?
Everywhere we go, you get this sense of fatigue. People are tired of this war. Of course, people in Ukraine, I'm sure, much more fatigued with what's happening. But as I say, more and more Russians are starting to realise that this is happening, that their lives have been affected by it. More and more people I speak to know other people who've been fighting in Ukraine and people who've been killed in Ukraine. Wherever you go, that you see cemeteries filling up with soldiers who were killed in Ukraine. There are more and more war memorials. So this is hanging over Russia. And, you know, with the war in its fifth year and sort of no end in sight to it, people are getting tired of it. And people are tired of the economic consequences of the war and the economic consequences of sanctions. Their communal bills, their utility bills have been going up. Prices in the shops have been going up. And on top of all of that, you have this deep sense of frustration and irritation, and in some senses, anger, over restrictions that the state has imposed on the internet. This is all coming together.
Chris Miller, let's talk about Ukraine for a moment and the feeling in Kyiv now. In February, Ukraine was coming out of that terribly cold winter caused by Russia attacking the country's energy infrastructure. What's the mood now?
Well, if you compare it to winter, people are certainly in much better mood. This was the harshest winter since I think I've been in Ukraine, and I've been here about 16 years. Compounding the extreme cold temperatures were these massive Russian missile and drone attacks that nearly plunged Kyiv, the capital of nearly 4 million people, into darkness and brought it to the brink of catastrophe. Contrast that with today, and as we're speaking, it's sunny, very warm, and the situation on the battlefield has changed, and in the war generally has changed. Ukrainians are feeling, if not cautiously optimistic, certainly as though things have maybe taken a slight turn in their favor. The Russians are growing increasingly frustrated, not only Russian society, but I think on the battlefield, they're really just inching forward and at enormous cost, suffering casualties upwards of 35,000 a month on the battlefields of southern and eastern Ukraine. They are still launching these large-scale missile and drone attacks, but the Ukrainians are increasingly doing so themselves. And of course, the long-range drone attacks are targeting areas much further than Moscow. They're hitting oil refineries and other energy facilities. They're striking military logistics. These are all things that the Ukrainians are really pleased about. Their domestic weapons production is really coming along. That's something that they feel has helped sort of swing a little bit of the momentum back in their favor.
And has Volodymyr Zelensky himself managed to benefit from that? We talked in an earlier program about the difficulties he was in because of the corruption scandal.
He does what he can to separate the two, domestic politics and the war. And a lot of Ukrainians are no longer sort of keeping a lid on their public criticism of the president when it comes to matters of domestic politics and corruption. There are still investigations ongoing. They have just in recent days charged Zelensky's former very powerful chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, with corruption, accusing him of embezzling. He's denied these charges. But when it comes to Ukrainian support for their wartime president, they still are backing him. They don't want elections, for example, to happen as long as the war is underway. You know, Zelensky is still enjoying quite a lot of popularity.
Right. I want to come on to the twin questions of the way in which the war has been conducted, and also the very important question of Vladimir Putin's own standing in Russia. But first, I want to go to Angela Stent to look at the view from the United States. So Angela, last time we had you on the program, we were talking about this strange initiative which had been launched by the Trump administration, which I think got called the Witkoff-Dmitriev plan. What happened to that?
Well, I think it should have been called the Dmitriev-Witkoff plan, because if you read it, it literally looked as if it was translated from Russian with sort of strange syntax. So the Russians, when they talk about the peace plan, still say it's the 28-point peace plan. So Yuri Ushakov, close advisor to Vladimir Putin, Kirill Dmitriev, who still makes frequent trips to Miami to visit Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, they still talk about it. But what happened to it was almost immediately, the Europeans and the Ukrainians said this is completely unacceptable because it was essentially a capitulation to Russian demands. And so we've had for months a 20-point peace plan. I don't think I've ever seen the final version of it, but it, again, worked out between Europe and Ukraine. And it looks as if it's accepted by the U.S., which would be much more favorable towards Ukraine. It could keep a significant its army, its armed forces, and it would not be forced to withdraw from those parts of the Donbas, which Russia doesn't control. But at the moment, I think it's very hard to say what, if any, peace plan has been agreed upon by all sides. In fact, it hasn't. And so we hear about it from the Russians sometime, including what they call the spirit of Alaska, where they claim agreements were made between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin when they met in Alaska last summer. But again, that's not something even that the Trump administration talks about.
In other words, the Trump administration doesn't feel the spirit of Alaska anymore. I mean, Angela, does that mean that there's an increasing view in Washington, say, de facto, that this is actually a European problem, that it's for the Europeans to sort out?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've just come back from a conference in Tallinn, Estonia, where we had American officials, European officials, and that's essentially what U.S. officials are saying and what President Trump and certainly Vice President Vance is saying. This is for the Europeans to solve. It's their problem. They should be supporting Ukraine. They should give it weapons. They should give it financial support. And it really isn't our war anymore. In other words, the idea that it really doesn't affect the U.S.
Steve Rosenberg, is there still hope in Moscow, though, that President Trump can reignite the spirit of Alaska that we've just heard about and broker a peace which is favourable to Russia?
It's interesting. When Vladimir Putin was in Beijing, one senior Russian official said, well, he'd never used the phrase the spirit of Anchorage, but he was talking about the spirit of Beijing. So it's almost as if it never happened. But there's no doubt that the Russians had been confident, I think, that Donald Trump was the man who would put pressure on Volodymyr Zelensky to make the kind of concessions that Russia wanted to force Ukraine to pull out, at very least, pull out of the Donbass completely. That is Russia's bottom line. That's what Russia continues to demand. And it hasn't happened. And actually, if you read some of the Russian papers, and I try to follow them on a daily basis, there are plenty of articles now suggesting that, well, hope is fading, that President Trump is going to be the man to actually bring about the kind of end to the war that Russia wants.
Chris, what about the Zelensky and the Ukrainians? How do they view Trump's role?
I think you can look at Zelensky's evolving rhetoric. If last year he was certainly trying to curry favor with Trump, speaking very positively of him, certainly trying to get Trump back on his side after that disastrous Oval Office meeting between the two of them and J.D. Vance, where there was this big blow up that led to Trump cutting intelligence and weapons for a brief period of time. You know, now I think a little over a year later since then, the Ukrainians have managed to ramp up their own domestic production of weapons that are revolutionizing warfare. Trump has focused his attention instead on the war in Iran, and his special envoys, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, are no longer engaging in these trilateral peace talks with Russia and Ukraine. We haven't seen any trilateral meetings between those negotiators since February now. The Ukrainians are shifting gears, and instead of looking for a negotiated peace settlement, they are very confident in their ability now to fight on for several more months with their own domestic production being ramped up, with a new 90 billion euro loan from the Europeans. It's going to allow them to step up production even further, and while also keeping their economy and government afloat. They are not as reliant on American weaponry anymore, although they still do very much need and are asking for Patriot interceptor missiles, which are the only ones that can shoot down Russia's ballistic missiles that have been targeting critical infrastructure here. But they're much less reliant on Donald Trump and the United States at this particular moment in time. And just today, my colleagues and I at the Financial Times reported that Zelensky is talking with the Europeans about trying to get them more directly involved and in reaching out to the Russians to start negotiations or a new track of negotiations between the Russians, Ukrainians, with some type of European leader or former leader brokering those talks.
Let's note the symmetry there between what you just said and what Angela said, which is it looks likely, both from the American point of view and from the Ukrainian point of view, that Europe is actually becoming the key actor in this rather than the United States, Chris.
I think that's right. You know, Europe has taken on much more of a role in this war. Certainly that is what Donald Trump has asked for. But I think the Europeans have finally come around and understanding just how important Ukraine is to the security of Europe.
Steve, I want to talk now about the man who essentially whose war this is. What's the current situation with Vladimir Putin? There's been some discussion recently that perhaps he's losing ground at home and may be subject to some criticism, even from quite close to hand.
I think there's no doubt that the pressure has been growing on Vladimir Putin. There was some reporting in the West that, you know, he's become more reclusive. He spends a lot of time in bunkers. I don't get that sense here. I mean, he has been making quite a few appearances in the last few days, and obviously big trip to China. He has been speaking to the pool of Kremlin journalists a little bit more frequently recently. But there's no doubt that the fact that this war has gone on so long, that Russia hasn't achieved victory in the so-called special military operation, which was only supposed to last a few days or a few weeks maximum, and has caused so many casualties on the battlefield and weakened the Russian economy. This is all pressure on Vladimir Putin. It does not mean, however, that the Putin political system is about to collapse. I think there is a bit of strength there. It's difficult to know what's going on, of course, behind the Kremlin walls. There's no sense of a plot or, you know, an imminent coup, anything like that. But certainly the pressure is on Putin to reassert his authority. But I think the problem he faces is, as soon as he took that decision to launch the mass invasion of Ukraine back in February 2022, he set in motion processes which are going to be very hard to reverse. This sort of destabilization of the system, which we didn't see to begin with, but, you know, more than 4 years into the war, we're seeing it now. And it's becoming much harder, I think, to sort of stabilize the system. It doesn't mean that it's going to collapse, but it's a bigger challenge for him now.
Is there actually any kind of data from polling which tells us anything useful about attitudes to Putin?
Yes, there is. There are several polling agencies here. How accurate the numbers themselves are, we can discuss that. But they show an interesting trend. There is a state polling organization which showed that Vladimir Putin's approval rating fell 7 weeks in a row. As I say, it's not the number itself which is important, it's the trend. And this is a state-run polling organization. And suddenly, the organization stopped publishing this weekly figure. For a couple of weeks, they didn't post anything. And then the latest figures show a rise in his approval rating. But the organization points out they've changed the methodology for doing this. So I think there's no doubt. And just speaking to people on the streets, you know, you get a sense that people are not happy with the authorities. Now, I wouldn't ask people on the streets of Russia, you know, do you support Putin? Are you against Putin? That could get people into trouble. But you can feel the growing sense of frustration with the authorities and the sense that people do not know what the future brings. And I think that has an effect on what people think about the Kremlin.
Angela, you watch Putin from some distance, but obviously are analytically able. What do you make of him?
Well, I think you have to look at what happened on May the 9th. You know, this very scaled-down victory parade. No military hardware. I think, and he was admitting by having this scaled-down victory parade, that Russia is much more vulnerable to Ukrainian strikes than anyone had wanted to say. But I would also agree with Steve that we shouldn't exaggerate this. This is a very repressive system. Putin is surrounded by people who are there to protect him. I don't see any move among those around him to get rid of him. You know, the last time that really happened was when Nikita Khrushchev was fired, and those kind of institutions don't exist anymore. So I think we shouldn't jump to conclusions. Everyone wants to say, oh, here's an example of where his popularity is falling and people are complaining. You know, he's not about to be overthrown. And then I say that. And of course, when you study Russia and when you live there, you can always be surprised by things.
Oh, I was going to ask you, Steve, you were at that parade.
Yes, I was at the Victory Day parade, and it felt very strange because normally there are so many journalists sort of tussling for a place on the edge of Red Square to get a good view. There were very few journalists there, and you could feel it was a scaled-down parade. There were fewer guests, and of course, no military hardware, no tanks, no missiles. And the Victory Day parade, and Victory Day itself, the anniversary of the Soviet victory in World War II, is such an important, well, it's the foundation stone, if you like, of Putinism, of Putin's ideology, of this presentation of Russia as a nation of victors. And if you scale back on Victory Day and scale back on the Victory Day parade, that kind of weakens the foundation stone of the ideology. And I was chatting to Russians just before Victory Day and asking what they thought about the fact that there were going to be no tanks and no missiles going across the square. And yeah, people didn't like it. But I wanted to say that, you know, the Kremlin controls the messaging in Russia. It controls the media to a large extent. If you control the messaging, then you can try to shape public opinion. And what's happening at the moment is, in order to try to prevent Russians from joining the dots and thinking, well, our growing problems are the result of the president's decision to launch a mass invasion of Ukraine, there is a definite rise in sort of anti-Western, particularly anti-European propaganda in the state media here. Europe is sort of public enemy number one, and Europe is being accused of prolonging the war in Ukraine. So you do hear the word war now a lot. But what Russians say is this is a war being waged by Europe, by the West, against Russia in Ukraine. And all the blame is put on Britain, Germany, France, the EU, NATO. I think to prevent Russians from thinking that actually it's the fault of the president.
Chris, whole books are going to be written about this, and we don't have enough time to do it justice. But how has it come about that Ukraine has revolutionized warfare in the last few years?
Well, it's been born out of necessity. Ukraine came into this war with still very much a Soviet-style or post-Soviet military. We'll remember going back, to 2014 when Russia launched its first covert invasion of Crimea and then the Donbass. I remember speaking with the president at the time, the interim president at the time, who told me that they had only 6,000 active duty standing soldiers who were ready to fight and had the skills to do so. You know, fast forward to today, and everything that they've done has been, again, out of necessity. They've been fighting a bigger, stronger Russian military that has the ability to scale up faster and in bigger ways than it has. But it has mobilized its entire society. You know, local tech titans here, businesses, steelworking plants, everybody has pitched in. They've used whatever skills they have to transform factories that made household appliances suddenly to producing drones. There are parties that people hold on the weekends here in which they get together and they make food and drink wine and they build FPV, small first-person view drones. So this is an entire society that has mobilized itself around the war effort. Many of them have higher education, experience in working in tech, and they've transformed this country into a hotbed of military innovation. And they're getting a lot of help from their Western partners now. It's improving exponentially, and it will only continue to be to move on that path.
Angela.
Depending on which country you're talking about, people have understood that in this 21st century warfare, the Ukrainians are leaps ahead of many countries, including, by the way, the United States and some of these drone technology. So I would put that together with what's happened since the attacks on Iran. Ukraine has now become an important provider for the Gulf states. In fact, the Ukrainians have also signed agreements with the United States to produce some of these drones and with different European countries. So I think there's a new understanding that Ukraine isn't some weak country. It represents the future of warfare.
Let's move on to look ahead. Steve, in Russia, is there any sense at all that you get from anybody you talk to of how this war might end?
Most of the people we speak to on the streets talk about the need for a negotiated settlement. When you talk to commentators or pundits or officials, you don't hear that. I think many Russians are just waiting for Vladimir Putin to decide when he is ready to end this war. And what comes after that, I think, is a concern for people. Because even when the war ends, there are going to be big problems inside of Russia. And the authorities realize this. The thought of hundreds of thousands of traumatized Russian soldiers coming back from the front line to their towns and villages and cities, that potentially is going to create instability across the country.
Steve, do we have any sense at all about how likely it is or the pressure on him to declare somehow an end to the war?
We can see there are economic pressures on the country and on the president. We can see from other polling that the level of anxiety amongst the Russian public is going up. So on the one hand, there are pressures. At the moment, we see no evidence that this is influencing Vladimir Putin's decision-making. His demands haven't changed so far. He's still demanding that Ukraine pulls out of the Donbass. And I think his long-term goal of trying to ensure that the whole of Ukraine is somehow under Russian influence, I don't think that has changed either. So the pressures may be rising in society, but at the moment, they're not affecting his decision-making process. Now, at some point down the road, perhaps that will change. But right now, he seems determined to push on with his demands and to push on with his war.
Angela, I'm going to ask you to adopt an Olympian position. You're looking down on all this with your best conceivable guess about how this could end. It's obviously an almost impossible question, but it's your impossible question.
So first of all, Putin will only end this war, in my opinion, if he really believes he can't win. And I think at the moment, despite everything we've said about Ukraine's prowess in this war, he still believes that he can win. He still believes that the Ukrainian population will get tired of this and that Ukraine will have no choice. And he's still waiting for Donald Trump to pressure Zelensky to give up the Donbas. But that's really not happening at the moment. He probably won't stop the war until he believes that he can't win, unless, you know, there is some catastrophic economic situation in Russia and the pressure on him is so great that he has to do it. But I don't see that so far.
Now, Chris, at the moment, we've been talking about the pressures on Russia and you've been talking about the reasons why Ukrainians could be more optimistic. But I imagine that there's still a fearful toll that the war takes on Ukraine and there are great difficulties as a consequence.
That's true. The Ukrainians have taken enormous casualties. Cities and towns have been decimated here. They want an end to the war as badly as anyone else, but they don't want to capitulate. They don't want to hand over this part of the Donbas that remains under Ukrainian control because they believe that once it's either handed over or forcibly taken by Putin, that he'll demand more. You know, they're under no illusions that they're going to get a negotiated settlement here. Putin still feels confident that he can win this war. I don't see him personally stopping short of something that he can declare an all-out victory and a Ukrainian defeat. Certainly, that has been one of the hangups in these trilateral negotiations between the Americans, Russians, and the Ukrainians. I think the Ukrainians understand that very well. And, you know, the only thing that they would settle for is a true negotiated and fair settlement. But they just don't see Vladimir Putin wanting that at the moment. And so they're prepared to fight on and they're doing what they can to strengthen their military, to strengthen their relationships with the U.S. if possible, but especially right now with the Europeans. And so, you know, they're prepared to fight on for, if not many months, then another couple of years or a few years even.
My thanks to Steve Rosenberg, Angela Stent and Christopher Miller. And just before we go, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, which includes the one which looks back over the last 10 years to mark the 10th anniversary of the Briefing Room, and the one which asks whether smartphones should be banned for young people. And that was the last programme in the current series, but we'll be back again at the beginning of July. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard. And the editor was Richard Varden.
If you've got a scrolling problem, then this is the podcast for you.
It's called Top Comment with me, Matt Shea.
And me, Mariana Spring. We both investigate social media for a living.
Whether it's disinformation, conspiracy theories, internet culture, memes.
We're going to be getting behind the stuff that is popping up on your feed on this podcast.
That's Top Comment on BBC Sounds.